help us understand on a much broader scale how permafrost thaw is occurring.
NASA flies over the interior, studying the ground below. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the debate over the effect hatchery fish have on wild stocks intensifies.
Questions of how much is too much, or whether there's harm or not, are very difficult to answer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
Two major oil developments in the Arctic could get the final go-ahead from the Trump administration this fall. The Bureau of Land Management today released its final environmental review for an oil drill site in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, west of Prudhoe Bay. Called the Greater Mooses 2 Tooth 2 project, it's being proposed by ConocoPhillips. The other project nearing approval would be the first offshore oil production in federal Arctic waters. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management released its final environmental review for the proposed Liberty project last week. Oil company Hillcorp aims to build the Liberty project in the Beaufort Sea just east of Prudhoe Bay. Before signing off on the oil developments, the Trump administration has to wait 30 days after the final environmental reviews are published. That means both the Liberty Project and Greater Mooses Tooth 2 could get the green light as soon as October 1st. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, is best known for its exploration of the world beyond our planet. But on a recent NASA science flight over interior Alaska, the plane never left Earth's orbit, and the thing being studied was the ground. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig went along for the ride and has this report.
It's spitting rain at Eielson Air Force Base as the six-person NASA team files onto a small business jet. If you'd expect a NASA science plane to be all polished steel and shiny computer screens, you'd be wrong. There are some metal racks with monitoring equipment mounted on them, but this plane was built in 1983 and looks it. There's old wood paneling and beige leather seats with brass seat belts.
It's a former Air Force plane that used to fly generals around, and NASA got it as a government surplus.
Peter Griffith is an earth scientist with NASA, but on this flight, he's known as the SOB.
Scientist on board. Or in Peter's case.
Well, they do like calling me the SOB.
It fits.
That's Griffith's colleague, Tim Miller. So, what is the science being done on board this airplane? It has to do with a piece of equipment we can't see from inside, a super fancy radar stuck to the bottom of the plane that jumps into action once we're up at 41,000 feet, Griffith explains.
So the radar is now shooting off the left wing of the plane. It's picking up the vegetation structure, it's picking up the ground surface, and it's picking up a little bit of information about how much soil moisture is in the top of the soil.
That information, whether there's forest, shrub, or tundra below us, whether the ground is rising or sinking, and what the soil moisture is, will help NASA answer a larger question.
The information that we're getting on this flight will help us understand on a much broader scale how permafrost thaw is occurring across this area.
Permafrost isn't the only thing that NASA's here to study. This flight is part of a much bigger project they're leading to look at environmental changes in Alaska and Northwest Canada, many of them driven by climate change. NASA's big strength is collecting information from way above the Earth. This lets them look at a huge area, 2.5 million square miles. But they're also partnering with dozens of institutions to conduct research on the ground that ties into what they're collecting from the air. Griffith shows me a slide on his computer where they're all listed.
When I put this slide together, we had 379 U.S. science team members.
At the end of this flight campaign, NASA and their partners will have a ton of data about how things are changing in a huge swath of the North. But they're not going to conduct these flights forever. They're expensive. So another goal of the project is to refine some of the technology they're using so it can be mounted on satellites. That way, NASA can monitor these changes on a regular basis going forward. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig, back on the ground in Fairbanks.
Communications that prompted the Fairbanks North Star Bureau to close its administrative center 2 days last week do not rise to the level of criminal threats. Fairbanks Police Spokeswoman Yumi McCullough says police completed an investigation into alleged threats and charges are not warranted. Bureau Chief of Staff Jim Williams says no additional threats have been received since last week. The Bureau closed the Juanita Helms Administrative Center Thursday night and Friday out of concern for employees and public safety. Williams says the facility reopened Monday with heightened security. The Bureau never publicly identified the source of the alleged threats, but Chris Ripple, a Bureau resident whose property had been foreclosed on for failure to pay taxes, said last week he exchanged communications with Bureau staff challenging their authority to take his land. Ripple's house burned last Thursday, 2 days prior to when the property was scheduled to be sold at a Bureau foreclosure auction. The auction was subsequently postponed to a yet-to-be-announced date. Troopers are investigating the fire. This year's 40-mile caribou hunt has yielded a record harvest. The herd size is estimated at about 72,000 animals, the largest it's been since peaking in the hundreds of thousands nearly a century ago. Alaska Department of Fish and Game area biologist Jeff Gross says the herd's recent growth prompted a larger fall harvest quota of 1,500 bulls.
This year's harvest along the Steese Highway was at least double, if not triple, of what we have been able to allow in past years.
Gross says hunters have so far killed about 1,000 bulls, mostly in Zone 1 along the Steese Highway north of Fairbanks, over 3 days earlier this month, with additional take to the north in Zone 4, where hunting closes at midnight tomorrow. Gross lists three factors that contributed to the high harvest along the Steese Highway.
We had the majority of the herd on the Steese Highway side of their range, and hunter participation was high, and they were able to access caribou along the Steese Highway, and there was good weather, so all those things combined.
The state hunt for 40-mile caribou continues in roadless Zone 3 and in Zone 4 along the Taylor Highway until the fall 1,500 animal quota is met. Another 500 animals are allocated to winter hunts. Gross says the 40-mile herd is being monitored closely for nutritional stress. This will be the first year of a 5-year pause in a state intensive management strategy that targeted wolves to boost the herd's size. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Anchorage School District begins its first language immersion program in an Alaska native language.
I believe language is very important because that's how our ancestors grew up speaking.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Well, a sign of fall or maybe winter, snow is creeping down the Alaska Range as low pressure pushes across the interior today. National Weather Service meteorologist Ryan Metzger says remnants of tropical storms are bringing substantial moisture into the region.
You are expecting like a quarter to a half of an inch of rainfall in through tomorrow morning. And in some of the higher elevations, like perhaps like along the Park Road in Denali National Park, above 3,000 feet, we could see up to 3 inches of snow.
Snow is also forecast in the eastern Brooks Range, where systems are expected to drop 2 to 4 inches through tomorrow morning, and then another 4 to 6 inches over the weekend. Some snow is expected to accumulate on the Dalton Highway, and the National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning from Friday to Saturday for snow in the eastern Brooks Range. As for a longer-term snow forecast for Alaska this winter, climatologist Brian Brettschneider with the University of Alaska Fairbanks says it's still too early to tell. But he says there are some indications that the tropical Pacific may be headed into an El Niño period.
El Niño winters are typically warmer and, in many cases in Alaska, wetter, but a lot of times that wetter is actually rain and not snow. So usually there's a little less snow than a non-El Niño winter, but it's really a kind of a roll of the dice this far out to make a prediction one way or the other.
Even so, Brettschneider says the question he gets asked the most by far is how much snow will we get this winter? Last month, the U.S. Forest Service announced it would be taking steps to build new roads in the Tongass National Forest. Now, the agency is asking the public to weigh in. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins explains.
Federal legislation prohibits most states from constructing roads on national lands. But Alaska has been in a decades-long battle to change that. One of the reasons is having enough access to harvestable timber. Over the summer, Senator Lisa Murkowski visited the last large mill in the region. But the Forest Service maintains that Southeast Alaska's dying timber industry isn't the only reason the agency is considering the state's ask. There are other economic opportunities, like mining, which would benefit from new roads. This process has drawn sharp criticism from environmental groups and tour operators who say this conversation shouldn't be rehashed, especially since the Forest Service has already gone to great lengths to collaboratively manage the Tongass. The Forest Service hopes to have a decision on Tongass road building by 2020. The agency will be holding public meetings throughout Southeast Alaska in September and taking public comment until October 15th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Recently, an argument over whether hatcheries are causing more harm than good has been heating up. The debate is nothing new, but an Alaska Department of Fish and Game study is about to take a step toward answering a question central to the debate. Do hatchery fish that spawn with wild populations pose a threat to those stocks? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Aaron Bolton has the story.
Okay, so basically you want to make two cuts, one to get at the heart and one to get at the otoliths.
Pete Rand is a research ecologist with the Prince William Sound Science Center, and he's showing a group of new field staff how to sample pink salmon carcasses on the banks of Hartney Creek just outside of Cordova. Rand picks up one of several pinks lined up on the rocks in front of him and cuts just behind its gills before using a pair of tweezers to tear off a tiny piece of its heart. Then he cuts into the skull, or brain case as he calls it, and extracts two white otoliths, or ear bones. They're smaller than the head of a pin.
I basically put my fingers in the eye socket, and you basically want to just take the top of the head off. Again, be very careful. You don't want to go
under a microscope. Fish and Game will be able to tell from the ear bones if each fish was raised in a hatchery. In just a few days, three field crews will travel to five remote streams on the western side of the sound, where they will repeat this ritual thousands of times.
We sample from the very beginning of the spawning season all the way to the end, and we sample daily. And so the objective there is to sample as many of the spawning pink salmon as we can.
This study and previous work has shown that the closer a wild stream is to a hatchery, the more likely hatchery fish will stray into that system.
Streams that are generally in the western part of the sound and generally closer to the hatcheries have relatively high hatchery fractions, up 70, 80, sometimes 90%.
The big concern is that when those strays spawn with wild fish, they're passing on genes that could reduce future generations' genetic fitness. In other words,
does having a hatchery origin parent, does that influence your survival in nature? And so that's the ultimate question we're trying to get at with this field project.
To answer that question, the samples are shipped to Fish and Game's genetics lab in Anchorage. Any heart tissues belonging to hatchery fish are discarded, but the ones from wild pinks are processed.
And we take a small piece of that heart and then put it in a tube, add a bunch of chemicals, go through a bunch of different reactions, and pull out the DNA.
Chris Hobbish manages the lab. He explains that after about a week of processing, his team can identify lineages of wild pinks and fish with varying degrees of genes passed down from hatchery stocks. The number of returning offspring each family tree produces will indicate whether hatchery fish reduce the productivity of wild stocks they spawn with. but that's about as far as the answers will go.
So if we do find a difference between these natural origin, hatchery origin fish in terms of how many progeny they produce, we won't know what the mechanism for that difference is.
While that may be a step forward in Fish and Game's eyes, the study has its critics. They argue the project, which received a large chunk of funding from hatchery operators and processors, is biased, and that it doesn't include a control stream with little or no hatchery influence to compare results to. Bill Templin is Fish and Game's chief fisheries scientist. In his Anchorage office, he acknowledges some of the study's shortcomings.
So it's very difficult to find a control. What we did, though, is controlled for high stray rate streams and low stray rate streams, so you get some sense of a contrast.
Templin says what the study does provide shouldn't be overlooked. He says the results will be valuable to the department and the Board of Fisheries when hatcheries request production increases or other permit changes. But he cautions against any notion that this study will spark a major shift in hatchery management. He says it's just a first step, and that the results alone might not be the best way to answer the question at the heart of the hatchery debate.
Questions of how much is too much or whether there's harm or not are very difficult to answer because they also require a human valuation, a huge human judgment. And that has to be worked out in a different venue than in a scientific study.
Those decisions may play out on the Board of Fish, which is scheduled to hold its first work session on hatcheries in October. However, it may do so without any results from Fish and Game's Hatchery Wild study. The first report is due in December. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Last week, Governor Walker declared an economic disaster for the Chignik fisheries region, prompted by devastatingly low sockeye returns. The Chignik River fell far short of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's minimum escapement goal of 550,000. As of early August, only about 400,000 reds had returned. There were no commercial salmon fishing opportunities in the region targeting sockeye. In a press release, Walker's office stated that these low numbers threaten the communities that rely on fishing. The announcement allows the legislature to appropriate money for assistance grants. The governor can also make budget recommendations to accelerate the region's existing capital projects and provide funding for new ones. Additionally, the declaration waives specific provisions of Alaska statute and regulations relating to capital project requirements, employment, and contractor preference. Additional support for Chignik area residents is available from the Division of Public Assistance, which provides food relief and financial assistance to Alaskans in need.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Officials with the Japan-based companies that own the Pogo gold mine northeast of Delta Junction have transferred their interest in the mine to an Australian-based firm for $260 million. A Pogo news release issued Wednesday afternoon says Sumitomo Metal Mining Company and Sumitomo Corporation will transfer all interest in the Pogo mine to Northern Star Resources by October. Sumitomo Metal Mining Pogo spokeswoman Wendy McNaughton says Northern Star officials have said they don't predict the sale will have any impact on the 320 workers at the mine, which is located about 38 miles northeast of Delta.
Northern Star is really intent on continuing the normal operations at Pogo. They are keeping all the employees. The employees will maintain all their normal terms and conditions. And really, it's business as usual at the mine.
The news release says Northern Star is a major gold producer that operates numerous underground gold mines in Australia. The company will take on all of the assets and liabilities of the Pogo mine, the release says. McNaughton says Northern Star officials say they'll continue expansion of the mine that Sumitomo officials have been planning to exploit new gold prospects discovered over the past couple of years.
As they say, they don't buy mines to close mines. They buy mines to extend the life of mine and to really invest a lot in exploration and to grow operations. So they are very optimistic. I don't think the purchase would have happened if they were not.
The Pogo mine began operation in 2006. A historic building that played an essential role in Alaska's history has been sitting vacant for nearly 30 years. The Government Hill Wireless Station used to connect Anchorage with the rest of the world. As Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry reports, one man is trying to make sure it is not forgotten.
There's no placard marking the historical significance of the wireless station. Just three dilapidated buildings sitting in an overgrown lot surrounded by suburban homes. And then a man in a wooden bow tie appears from around the corner.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm Aaron.
Hello, Aaron. Connor.
Nice bow tie.
Thanks.
Connor Schur pulls out a drill to unscrew the door of the main building. It's topped with the original cupola, which once served as a waypoint for Anchorage's port.
So this has sunken through, so don't step in it.
Okay, I won't.
We step inside. Graffiti covers the walls and bits of glass litter a sunken floor. But there are some reminders of the building's glory days, like an old telephone and a painted map of Alaska. For more than three decades, the station supplied radio communication between Anchorage and the outside world. Station employees radioed Nome during the winter of 1925 to tell the community life-saving serum was on its way, a trip that later inspired the Iditarod. And it was instrumental in the construction of Alaska's railroad. But now, it's abandoned.
I believe it won't be occupiable within the decade, so there is that added impetus to do something.
Schur wrote his master's thesis on the station. He wanted to memorialize it by telling its story. He started researching the buildings while interning for the city's historic preservation plan.
I just continued to get interested and inspired by the story and the history that was here, and how specifically that no one really remembered it outside of the neighborhood. No one has heard of the structure.
Some residents of Government Hill want to see the buildings restored. Some want the property turned into a tourist destination, and some want it to serve the community in some way, like as a library or housing. That's what Schur wants, too.
There is a chance for it to serve the neighborhood with an actual use, not just as a spectacle in a field, which too often is the fate of historic buildings.
The Federal Alaska Engineering Commission built the first of the three buildings in 1917 to facilitate communication for railroad construction. Schur says the development of the station corresponded with the development of Anchorage.
This was an arrival of modernization to this frontier.
In 2015, it was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The city now owns the property, and last year they put out a request for proposals for someone to develop it. But no one responded. Dealing with extensive repairs and hazards like asbestos would be pricey. And until someone foots the bill, an important piece of Alaska's telecommunications history will continue to crumble. In Anchorage, I'm Mary McKinstry.
The Anchorage School District has immersion programs in languages like German, Spanish, and Japanese. But until recently, the district had no immersion program for Alaska Native languages. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, a kindergarten class in Anchorage has taken the first step in a Yupik program this week with plans to continue all the way through high school graduation.
In Lorena Warren's kindergarten class at College Gate Elementary, students are learning the first letter of the Yupik alphabet, A. The kids are sitting in a circle, passing a ball around and saying ah, and then the word for ball, ahangak. While some of the students whisper in English to each other, Warren is only speaking Yupik. It's part of a new language immersion program where the students spend half of their day learning in Yupik. The classes are modeled after the Lower Kuskokwim School District, where Yupik is spoken more commonly. Warren teaches one class in the morning and another in the afternoon. The idea is that these kids will spend their entire school careers in a program like this, ending high school as fluent Yupik speakers. Warren sees teaching language as a way to preserve culture.
I believe language is very important because that's how our ancestors grew up speaking. And right now we may have lost a lot, but what we have right now, I think it's important for these kids to learn it.
College Gate principal Daryl Burnson grew up in Old Harbor on Kodiak Island and is Aleutic. Burnson regrets that he didn't learn his native language as a child. Burnson has seen firsthand just how fragile native languages have become in the last few decades.
My first wife, her grandmother was the last known EAC speaker in the state of Alaska. And when she passed, which was unfortunately about 10 years ago, when she passed, we know that the last person that had the knowledge of the EAC language was gone.
Burnson says groups like the University of Alaska Fairbanks are working to preserve languages in a historical context, but that isn't enough. He thinks the best way to ensure languages don't die is by teaching children how to speak them fluently. He says the time was right to teach a native language in the Anchorage School District.
Over 11 different languages offered in the Anchorage School District, this is the first one that represents the people of Alaska.
Burnson says typically in language immersion programs, the students start behind their peers, but eventually catch up and surpass those in more traditional schools.
I think the people that got on board with this that are non-native or non-Yupik understand that it doesn't matter what language is being taught. As long as they're accessing two parts of the brain, their child is going to benefit from it in the long run.
Back in the classroom, the students have moved on to numbers, rolling large dice, hoping to roll a one, or atochik. Warren says, even though about half of the students in the class are Yupik, they all primarily speak English at home.
They may speak Yupik, but they're speaking to their kids in English. And I think having their kids in the Yupik program will make the parents try to speak to them in Yupik at home.
While currently there is only the kindergarten class in the immersion program, the plan is to add a new grade and instructor every year through high school graduation. Parents who want to send their children through the Yupik program enter the school district's lottery system. The lottery for next year opens January 1st. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage, Pravena Koenig, Dan Bross, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Aaron Boltman, Homer, and Isabel Ross in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.